Florida on the men's side and UConn on the women's side are the champions of the world. Our reactions to championship weekend here on the College Basketball Power Hour. Welcome into the College Basketball Power Hour on a National Championship Reaction Edition. He is Jason Fitz. That is Ice Young. They are both in San Antonio. I am Caroline Fenton. Just got back from Tampa. Guys, how we doing? How we feeling? And a post-National Championship high that we're riding.
The National Championship was the smaller story. Yesterday was Ice's birthday. I think that's a bigger story. But, I mean,
happy birthday, Ice!
Look, I mean, come on, let's go. Like, I look at her on TV and I'm like, you're working on your birthday. But like, I don't know, y'all. Like, I'm still in my feels. Can I just be honest? Like, that crowd last night in the dome was, and I say this gently, I think it was louder than a college football environment. And I don't know that I've ever heard that much of a 50-50 crowd. Like, I was stunned that Florida fans came out to the level they came out, and the Alamo Dome was packed to the top, and I mean, it was truly electric. Like, I had goosebumps for easily the first hour of that game, just listening to the crowds. And I thought Houston's crowd would be a huge part of it. Florida's crowd turned out to be too. So, like, what a magical night.
Yeah. The Gators do not play about traveling, guys. They show up. And I felt like the storylines behind, you know, Todd Golden and him being so young, winning his first championship, like, really made the run so much more historical or Cinderella-like. I know earlier in the show, we had shows weeks ago, we were like, it's not a lot of Cinderella going on. That might have been the Cinderella-esque type of thing that happened with Golden winning. I'll tell you, like, you know, we were at the Civic Center around the convention center with all the fans that were pouring in, and it was ludicrous. Like, it was great madness. So many different people showed up from all four number one seeds, even stayed to watch different number one seeds. The amount of Duke t-shirts I saw yesterday was probably too many for comfort at this point in the season, but they stayed around to watch a good game. It was fantastic. I think on the men's side, what you want is three really good games in the Final Four. And we got three terrific games in the Final Four, three games that included three teams coming back and winning games in which they weren't winning the majority of the game. Such a treat.
Florida's the first team in 20.
The college basketball gods took all of the good endings and the nail biters and the games that we're going to be talking about for the next 10 to 15 years and sprinkled all that fairy dust in San Antonio. In Tampa, we got a whole lot of blowouts. We will get into the Women's National Championship here in just a moment. But I saw when the Final Four was set, and I knew the national championship site was San Antonio. I thought if Houston gets there, that place is going to be 75% red, doesn't matter who their opponent is. But when I was leaving Tampa, every gate that was flying to any city in Texas, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, literally anywhere, every single gate was covered up with Florida fans. Obviously, it's Tampa, Florida fans in Tampa. So I did wonder what the crowd was going to be like. Obviously, my experience in the Tampa airport was very anecdotal, but it felt 50-50.
So here's how we know that this was crazy last night. When I did the national championship game last year, and I gave some of my friends that live in Texas this advice, about half, because you buy the tickets for a whole three-pack. You can't just buy the champ game in the beginning. You have to buy all three games. And so I told everybody that was looking for tickets, just wait till Sunday. Because last year when I was in Arizona and we had UConn versus Purdue, day of the game, like, the people were buying verified tickets for $20 to the championship game because everybody left town. Last night or yesterday, what I found out from my friends that were trying to go to the game is that tickets were actually skyrocketing through the course of Sunday. So if you waited until after the championship game was set, because so many people from Florida immediately were figuring out how to get there, and so many people from Houston wanted to get there, tickets were doubling and tripling on the secondary market yesterday. That speaks to how much, and it was impossible. There were so many people that, you know, to Ice's point, the city was overrun with people that got here and couldn't get into the game from both sides. So that's not just anecdotal. That's actual. Like, what we saw last night was the magic you don't usually get in a championship game.
Worth every penny, I would say, for every Florida fan who made that trip, who bought those tickets on the secondary market. The Florida Gators are national champions. They took down Houston 65-63. And whenever you watch Houston basketball, if you are a fan of points, of offense, of the Alabama Nate Oates style of shooting threes, 110-105 kind of games, Houston's not your jam. And that was kind of on full display last night. It was physical. It was defensive forward. But if you were able to stay up for the entirety of that game, because I don't know how many people really truly were, but if you were able to stay up for the entirety of that game, you saw that kind of Cinderella ending that you were talking about, Ice. You saw an ending that's how we want the national championship to end. That's how you want to, at least if you're a Florida fan, if you're a Houston fan, that's absolutely devastating. That's how you want to hoist a trophy at the end of the day. Walter Clayton Jr. follows up a massive offensive performance against Auburn, 34 points, with kind of a quiet day, at least on the box score. But Walter Clayton Jr. fits. He is the savior. He is the king of Florida basketball. It was the Walter Clayton Jr. show, at least in the second half.
Yeah, but not until the second half. And this is where the game got really interesting, particularly down the stretch, because, you know, I'm sitting next to Marcus Morris. I hope you guys watched a bunch of our content on Yahoo that we were all putting out. And Marcus kept saying early on, here's the key. You cannot press, because Walter Clayton Jr. was irrelevant in the first half. Yeah, he was dishing it out. I get he had some assists, but he wasn't even getting opportunities to take good shots. He had literally no points. Only the third time all year that he had a half where he had 0 points, right? So you're talking about a guy that, like, and Marcus kept saying it, one of these guys is going to feel the moment and they're going to press too much. And what did you see? Like, Walter Clayton Jr. didn't really get those opportunities until there was about 8 minutes left in the game. Then he got hot enough and then he was really starting to take over. At the same time, LJ Cryer on the other side started to press a little bit, was starting to look too hard for his shot, and Houston didn't feel like they had any other options. Like, I have to give Walter Clayton Jr. so much credit, because he let the game come to him. And when you're not having the game you've had in the rest of the tournament, I cannot imagine in that moment with 60,000 people screaming at you how difficult that is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he started the game taking very bad shots. I thought his first 5 or 6 shots that he took were ill-advised. I was like, hey, like, the score is only 2-3. It's not 68-67 with a second left, and you have to shoot the shot, Walter. Like, let the game come to you. But I'm more impressed with his facilitating, because anytime that you have a teammate who's dropped 30 points in the Elite Eight, 34 points in the national semifinal game, you're expecting them to put up big numbers. And so when you don't see him do that, how is your offense still flowing? Well, he was still connecting to his guys. He was still finding off the pick and roll, his rollers getting down low, knocking down shots. So I was impressed with the 7 assists that he had that were very much needed in order for Florida to win. It's so interesting, like, going into this game, it was like Florida's offense versus Houston's defense. And the main question that I had was like, hey, is Houston going to be able to slow down Walter Clayton Jr.? If they can slow him down, they have a chance to win a national championship. And this was my pick for the national championship. When Selection Sunday came out, we did our brackets. It was always, for me, Florida versus Houston. I felt like Florida's defense in the last 10 minutes of that game was the most impressive thing we have seen from that team the entire tournament. Not that Houston is this amazing scoring team, but it was the fact that they were in control of that game down the stretch. It was the fact that Houston was the aggressor for 30 minutes of that game. I mean, I was talking at halftime to Wally Zerbiak, and I'm like, Wally, like, Florida's getting punked out here. Houston is coming out, and they're just punking them on the boards. They're making sure that they're the aggressor. I feel like that last 10 minutes for Florida, they had to get stops in a row. They had to clean up on the boards, and then they had to get high percentage looks offensively. But really, to me, it was their defense that won them that game. And then Houston, 4 turnovers in the last minute of the game, like, not getting a shot up at the end. My heart went out to Emmanuel Sharp, because he catches the ball at the end, Caroline, and he goes to shoot it. And Walter Clayton Jr. is there, like, an amazing, fantastic closeout that not many people really highlighted, but he closed out fantastic. And Sharp, you know, shoots the ball and then drops it right away. And he's trying to, like, block everyone out so that way his teammates could get the ball. And unfortunately, it worked against him, because he really let the time off the clock. Technically, Fitz, if you ask, like, he either should have shot the ball and just got it blocked, shot the ball and go into the defender and you try to draw the foul. But at least after you throw the ball up and you're boxing everyone out, you got to realize at a certain point, our time is going down. Like, let me just pick the ball up and it's a turnover. And then at least we can foul. They have to make free throws and we can extend the game. So it was a very anticlimactic finish from that standpoint. But again, Florida's defense. We had talked about their offense all season long. In the end, it was their defense.
By the way, Marcus Morris was sitting there screaming repeatedly, touch the ball, touch the ball, because we all knew we needed the clock to stop. But I also want to stress, too, Florida, like Coach flat out said, Golden flat out said at the press conference the day before when we were all at breakouts and they were talking to everybody, when he was asked the key to the game, he said, every single rebound we get in this game is a win. We have to win. And the only way we'll do that is if we get those rebounds. It was close, but they out-rebounded Houston by one. That, to me, is the biggest – that's the biggest shocker of the game. That's the biggest story of the game, because if you control second possessions out of that – if you manage to do that against Houston, you can't beat them. Like, I don't want to sleep on the fact, as ugly as the ending was, let's remember, Houston was up by 12 in this game. And there were people sitting there saying, man, a 12-point deficit to Houston is like a 24-point deficit to everybody else. Their defense is suffocating. Well, on this particular night, Florida stayed calm. They controlled the boards. I mean, that changes everything. So it was wild to watch a team in Houston that just a couple of days ago managed to stay calm and rise. And then in this game, they did the exact opposite. Like, it's wild that a 48-hour switch could make such a difference to how they approached the last 3 minutes of the game.
It felt like Florida did to Houston what Houston did to Duke. And maybe not in the same exact form and fashion, but it felt the same. That you have a commanding and comfortable lead, and especially a lead like that, like you alluded to, Fitz. Houston does such a good job of wearing opponents down, of just making it so difficult, specifically in the second half, that if you can keep it close in the first, that is no guarantee that you can keep it close in the second. Because Houston's physicality and their conditioning, they just continue wearing you down. We saw it on full display with Duke. When Duke's backs were against the wall, when they needed to just make a play here and a play there, they couldn't. Their lack of being on that stage, I felt like, really shined through. Look at Florida. Look at the grind that they went through in the regular season of an SEC schedule, their non-conference schedule, and then look at Florida's path so far in the tournament. Florida was like, oh, our backs are against the wall. Oh, we absolutely need to just some sort of spark offensively. No problem. We can stay calm because we've been here before. We've been through this before. I thought going into this game, the two keys to victory for Florida were out shooting Houston, which they did not, and Walter Clayton having a huge day, which he did not. I think Florida just kind of went back to maybe what's made them so impressive all season long, and it's their depth, the fact that every single player that touched the ball had at least a point, that Walter Clayton Jr. didn't need to be Superman, that it was Alex Condon stepping up, that it was Will Richards stepping up, and that they all kind of were spreading the love around a little bit. And it was their defense. Like you said, even though it's just one more rebound than Houston had, that's really all you really needed with a team like Florida that can score like they can score.
There is one more element, though, that we haven't talked about. And I'm not saying that this was a problem. I want to say I think it was done balanced. But the change in officiating from the first half to the second half was a massive part of this game. And like in the first half, I mean, I was two rows off the court. And they were shoving each other to the ground in the first half. And the refs were letting it go. And immediately, and where I give them credit is they were letting it go on both ends of the court. So I'm looking at it and I'm saying, okay, as long as the officials are consistent, I don't care how they call it. In the second half, when they came out and it became so clear, and this is one thing that Ice can speak to, I didn't know until last night, because I'm sitting next to, four former NBA guys and two analysts. And the minute there were a bunch of calls on Florida right away, the first thing that all the guys kept saying is the refs are going to even this out. So when the technical foul happened and everybody was sitting there screaming, one thing that Marcus said, the guys kept talking about, was the coaches are getting their players together right now on Florida. And they're saying, hey, just lob it in, because right now there's such a differentiation on who the fouls are being called on. It will even out. Force the refs to make these decisions. They did that, right? Like, the calls evened out. What we saw, a slew of calls on Florida early, and then it balanced. And once this game was being called particularly tight in the second half, again, consistently on both ends, so I don't fault the refs, But it just felt like Houston didn't have an adjustment. And then they got frustrated, and their body language showed it. Like, they got in their own feels because they didn't like the way the game was being called. Everybody started to get super emotional. I don't think Houston was ready for that second half change. And that's just one of the variables that Florida did a better job in the game of handling, Ice.
I mean, first of all, you shouldn't have to adjust. Let me start there. Like, we're in the national championship game. It shouldn't be a tale of two cities, a tale of two halves of the fouls that were called in the first half, the fouls that were called in the second. You were right. They were letting those guys play. There were several plays where we're watching this game as a group with CBS and we're like, bro, that's a foul. They're not calling it. Okay, awesome. We're going to have a great basketball game. Houston, guys, was in the bonus for 17 minutes in the second half. Like, Florida had 17 fouls with 17 minutes left. Mm. How do you not win that basketball game? Every other 30 seconds, Houston should have been on the free throw line. And instead, it's Florida who makes 15 out of 19 free throws in the second half alone to win the basketball game. I mean, those guys did a great job of being on attack mode and just capitalizing on the moment, like Fitz said. I was disappointed with the officiating because you just want it to be consistent. And that's a hard thing to challenge a team to adjust to mid-game. And if you're resting, you go back and you look at the foul count, you're like, oh, okay, we got to even this up. Bro, it's going to lend towards the team that you're evening it up for towards the end of the game. So I also think that that was a tough aspect of this game. But all in all said and done, what a job like Todd Golden did. We were talking last night on CBS about, you know, if this championship solidifies him as one of the elite coaches now that exists. And fortunately for him, there are tons of elite coaches that we call elite that have only won one championship or that haven't won a championship yet. And so because he's got one, I feel like he has solidified himself as someone, and getting a national championship under 40 years old. Like, I mean, this man is going to be hungry. The last time Florida won a championship, they went back to back the next year in 06-07. That's a tough, tall task to say that they're going to have to do. But I think it could be cool if it happens. I think it could be cool if that's the storyline moving forward.
Yeah, moving forward, you know, I know the Florida Athletic Department, the Florida fan base as a whole, they're passionate. And it's the kind of fan base that if you build it, they will come. That Florida softball is a perennial contender. That sport has a lot of support. That, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, beach volleyball, cross country. If you are a national championship contender, you're going to get that kind of support from the fan base, and you're going to get that kind of buy-in from the athletic department. It's just it's a school, it's a program that's thirsty for success. Florida basketball has been striving to get back to those 06-07 years ever since then. And it's only gotten more and more difficult now that you're competing in an incredibly deep conference. It's only gotten more difficult in this new era of college sports. So now that Florida has a basketball national championship, not that there wasn't investment beforehand, because I don't think that you can win a national championship without investment all the way around, especially in this era of college sports. But now that they have a championship under their belt, I think it's going to be full speed ahead. And that's a program with a whole lot of boosters with incredibly deep pockets. And from, you know, kind of the retrospective, kind of looking back and reflecting on this team, we talk about this Florida program. They've got all the money. They've got all the investment. You know, it's Florida basketball. It's a rich history. Well, Todd Golden came from San Francisco, and Walter Clayton Jr. came from Iona, and Will Richard came from Belmont. Like, this is a team whose background is largely mid-majors, kind of humble beginnings. And I love that storyline with this Florida team. Like, yes, it's sure, it's the big bad Florida Gators, but it's this team that felt like an island of misfit toys that came together to be such a perfect combination.
That, Caroline, is the exact... So I came away with this theory over the course of the weekend. Because you start talking to these players, and we say Cinderellas are dead. Here's my theory. Cinderellas aren't dead. Cinderellas now are not about teams. They're about individuals. Like, so instead of looking for a mid-major team that's going to come up and shock the world. Look at the stories we saw over the course of the Final Four. Look at the players that we met over the course of the Final Four that maybe we knew, maybe we didn't, but you watched them rise from smaller programs to where they are now to have the chance to win a national championship. Isn't that the true Cinderella? To me, the number of players that were impactful in this process that wouldn't have had in a different college basketball landscape the opportunity to win this national championship. The fact that we're looking at, you know, Jahni Broome sitting there and answering questions about, you know, whether or not he should be the player of the year when just a few years ago he's at Morehead State. Like, that to me is the Cinderella. So maybe if we want to have a genuine conversation about the future of college basketball and Cinderellas, maybe the real genuine way to do that is to stop complaining about the teams and start acknowledging the individuals that are getting Cinderella moments that are absolutely beautiful. Because this weekend was full of them, and I like that story every bit as much because I got to see the best teams, I got to see the best basketball, and I got to see individual Cinderellas thrive.
I think that's a great theory. Point, Pitts.
Yeah.
Good theory.
It is a great point. I do want to point out, too, that the transfer portal works both ways. That when you have guys that maybe are undersized or under-recruited and they go to some of these mid and low majors, they get pulled back up to the top, so to speak. They get pulled up to the big leagues. Well, some of those guys who were heavily recruited, were the right size, don't fit and don't click at some of these Power Four programs. So they find their next home at a Belmont, at in Iona, at a Florida Atlantic, at a McNeese, whatever it might be. Obviously, those aren't the stories that are incredibly sexy. Those aren't the stories that we talk about because those aren't the programs that we see contending for a national championship. But I think it's totally fair and totally correct that we can fall in love with some of these individual stories. And although that's not the same as a true Cinderella St. Peter's going to the Elite Eight, it's still a really interesting story nonetheless. And Walter Clayton Jr., too, probably the clear-cut third-best player in the country behind Jahni Broome and Cooper Flagg, whichever order you want to rank those two. I thought that was pretty cool. I don't want to say revenge, but more so like, look at me now for Walter Clayton Jr. After the race and the discussion all season long was Jahni Broome or Cooper Flagg, Cooper Flagg or Jahni Broome. Neither of those two were competing for a national championship, and Florida largely won a national championship because of what he was able to do in the Final Four. So I kind of love that, like, I told you so moment for Walter Clayton Jr.
I need you guys' thoughts on this. Scale 1 to 10, how shocked were you that Duke lost?
10.
In the moment? Yeah. Like at 15?
10?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the craziest thing to me about the way that game ended is that Cooper Flagg has already accomplished so much that the whole Alamo Dome thought he was going to make that shot. Like, even though there's no proof of concept of Cooper Flagg hitting a game winner, we were all just in there like, well, it's been a hell of a game. Great effort by Houston. Cooper's going to hit the shot and Duke's going to go on. Like, I think the sad part of this, Ice, to your question, is that those Duke players are going to remember the way that game ended forever, just like the Houston players are going to remember. Like, the story of the Final Four is two teams melting down. I just never would have imagined that Duke would have done that.
And yeah. John Shire said after the game, like, I can sleep at night knowing that with the game on the line, the player of the year, Cooper Flagg, had the ball in his hands. And I agree with that. But any other play you draw up, if the ball is in any other player's hands, I'm probably thinking, what are you doing? Why would you do that? But it's not the fact that Cooper Flagg missed the shot. It's the fact that it came down to that point.
Right.
When they had a, what, 12-point lead with 10 minutes to go?
14 points.
Yeah.
And it comes down to that. Like, it's not about that shot. It's about what happened in the largely, you know, part of the second half that you just absolutely just lost it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why it's so tough for Houston because they had such an emotional win versus Duke. I mean, those guys battled and battled and battled. I didn't think Houston ran good offense in that game until 5 minutes left in the game. Otherwise, I thought Duke had completely taken them out of what they wanted to do. I thought Duke had a great game plan. But down the stretch, this time of year, experience matters. And you could just tell that Duke's young players had not been in that situation yet, under that type of pressure yet, where they could safely get the ball inbound, something that Fitz has been talking to us about, that he can't stand when teams can't get the ball inbound. Simple as that. Yeah, getting a defensive rebound. Obviously, you know, Cooper flags foul. Like, there were just so many little things that added up to a big moment for them. But to me, that was probably the most shocking thing that happened this tournament. Like, not shocked at Walter Clay Jr. dropping 30 back-to-back. Not shocked at, you know, maybe how Houston lost the basketball game and kind of just the meltdown, but really shocked that Duke had that much of a lead and seemed like they were the favorite going into this tournament. From all the people that we talked to, seemed like everyone had Duke picked to win it all and somehow let that slip out of their fingers. That, to me, was the most shocking of the Final Four.
I think, too, because we talk a lot about, you know, Duke, its youth, its inexperience. Well, it was largely the veterans in the second half that I thought were really melting down. The turnovers in the second half and the missed shots in the second half. Like, yes, this was a rather inexperienced, largely Duke team, and it starts with their head coach. But I just thought that is a unacceptable maybe isn't the correct word, because it's, you know, it's the Final Four, you know, you lose and you go home like that. But that is unacceptable for a team that had those expectations going into it, that had the player of the year, that had a 14 point lead, and you're not able to hang on to it. Like, that is just one that you're going to have to think about and deal with forever, and it's going to leave a bad taste in your mouth forever, and that just sucks, and you just hope that you can reload and get back to that same stage next year. Yeah, we talked a bit about how Florida kind of felt like that Cinderella. On the women's side, the lowest seeded team was a 2 seed. And it was the team that felt like a Cinderella, the team that had won more national championships than any other program in women's college basketball. The program that has been to the Final Four 16 of the last 17 years. The team with probably the best player in the sport. That was the Cinderella. And it felt like a Cinderella story. UConn beat South Carolina 82-59 in the national championship game. And my gosh, it felt like all of the, you know, the juice just kind of was let out of that South Carolina fan base in Tampa, because it was really over at halftime and largely over after the third quarter. But it felt like a Cinderella because Paige Bueckers finally got hers. In her fifth year at UConn, her final season at UConn, her final game wearing a UConn jersey, and she goes out with a national championship, UConn's first since 2016. Ice, just kind of your initial reactions to the game and to blowout, frankly, that I didn't see coming.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say I didn't see it coming, because it's not like UConn didn't go into Columbia, into South Carolina, what, 8 weeks before maybe, and beat them by 30 points on their home floor?
Like, maybe I should have expected it.
I know, but you just don't expect it to happen again. You know, we just don't expect a repeat of that in a national championship game. You expect both teams to get better. You expect South Carolina to make adjustments. I tell you what, though, that is the genius, though, that is Gino Auriemma. It just cannot be duplicated nor understated how dominant he has been. 12 titles over a 30-year period. He won his first one in 1995. This one, probably maybe the most emotional that we've seen Gino just throughout the course of the tournament. You know, he's getting a little bit older now, guys. So the players have called him pop-up throughout the season. And you're getting
that
pop-up feel. Yeah, seriously. Well, you're getting that pop-up feel where, you know, he's taking the time to joke with players. He's telling us how awesome they are. He's getting emotional. I think, to me, my favorite moment was seeing him and Paige hug towards the end of the game, once Paige was subbed out, knowing that they were going to win national championships, knowing that this was going to be her last game in a UConn jersey. And then what a run for Paige. I mean, probably no player that we have rooted for more in college basketball since Paige Bueckers. I mean, she was an AP Freshman of the Year her freshman year. Before there was Caitlin Clark, there was Paige Bueckers. And then she got hurt, went through several injuries. UConn didn't win championships. We kind of started to feel like, hey, maybe she's just going to have to be one of the greats of UConn history without winning a championship. And will she still be on the same level as a Breanna Stewart and a Fisa Collier? But then to see what Paige did in the tournament, career high 40 points, you know, making sure that her team got to the Elite Eight, Sweet 16. And then honestly, 30-point blowouts in the Final Four national championship game. They did all their work early in the tournament. I wouldn't have thought that they would have blown out both UCLA and South Carolina to get to this game. I'm really happy for Paige. I'm happy that her story ended this way. I think to a lot of hoopers who have been through injuries and have been through tough expectations and immense pressure, it shows you that if you stay humble, if you stay to the grind, if you focus on leadership, which Paige has been very clear that she wanted to be the best leader for her team this year, she led her team to a national title. I'm not sure what more we can say about her and her run. I think how I felt about her is how I felt later after Maya Moore's career. Uh-huh. You know, like, I'm just so grateful to have been here and to have witnessed this and to have been able to see her at the peak of her career. And what's next for her is amazing. And then just Gino, man, Gino. Like, is he the best college coach we've ever seen? Is now a fair question to ask.
And not just women's college coach. College coach.
Oh, no, I didn't say women's. Period. I didn't say basketball.
Yeah.
No.
College coach.
College coach. He's won a title in four different decades. Like, the longevity, the volume of championships, the number of star players that he's produced. I saw a photo that was put out on Twitter, and it was, the caption was like, everyone in this photo is a national championship, or a national champion, excuse me. It was Diana Taurasi, Sue Bird, Breanna Stewart, Maya Moore sitting in the stands right behind AZ Fudd, Sarah Strong, and Paige Beckers. Like, that is obviously the young who's who that's on the court, on the bench. And then sitting in the stands was the who's who, an all-star of WNBA players, of women's basketball players, period. And you look at the generations of women's basketball players that Gino Auriemma has produced, it is a very fair argument. 12 national championships across four decades, 40 years of excellence. In the years that they didn't win a national championship, they were still there. They were in the Final Four. They were in the Elite Eight. They were one of the top teams in the country. So I think it is 1,000% fair that we put Gino up there with the Nick Sabans of coaches in college sports, because he has only produced greatness.
Look also, guys, at who he just dominated. Like, I think who you beat has to be part of this conversation. Like, he just knocked the snot out of a Dawn Staley team at a level that we're just not used to seeing that happen. Like, we talked about it during the regular season after the 30-point win. And it's like, well, you don't do that to Dawn Staley. And I think that was everybody's mindset, you know, coming in, is you don't do that to Dawn Staley again. But I just have to stress at all of this that Paige Beckers winning a national championship is amazing. It's electric. It's what I thought was going to happen. I picked UConn. I thought she was going to be the most outstanding player. So I everything I saw is what I expected. That being said, it doesn't change anything about how I view Paige. And that's one of the important things to me over the course of the last 48 hours. Like, Cooper Flagg isn't less than to me because he didn't win a championship. He still had one of the great years we've ever seen. Like, Paige isn't greater than because she finally won a championship. Like, she's been the standard in women's college basketball to a certain level for a minute. And I felt relieved. Like, you asked, like, how do we feel about watching Duke? I felt relieved watching UConn win a championship because it would stop the stupidity of trying to minimize the accomplishments of Paige Beckers because the teams she were on didn't give her an individual championship. Like, I can't get behind that logic. So I thought it was a beautiful thing. But I also think we need to acknowledge, like, the best team in college basketball, not the best player throughout the course of the year, but the best team throughout the course of the year has been UConn. And they are deeper. They have a big three. There's just a level of, they have the greatest coach, right? I looked at all of this. I think UConn just finally didn't have anything weird happen. And that's just better to be lucky than good is something I say all the time. And sometimes I feel like UConn's been unlucky this year. It wasn't that they were lucky. It's just that none of those weird things happened in the process and they got the championship I think they deserved this season.
If I can say,
please,
they did get lucky and that they didn't face a USC with Juju Watkins.
That's fair.
Because let me tell you, most of us going into that game had USC advancing as a number one seed. And it sucked not having Juju in these games. Like, I'm not taking nothing away from UConn,
yeah,
but just the star power that we missed not having her. I don't know how many commercials she was in, guys, but I also loved that she was filling commercials. That we all know that this player is not in this tournament, but Juju is still in every other commercial throughout the tournament, both in the men's and women's games. It was really cool to see. Yeah, I feel like you're absolutely right. Like, nothing bad happened to UConn. There were no last minute injuries. Everyone was healthy. You talked about the depth. And for me, it's a team that is easily going to reload, which is not surprising because it's Gino Auriemma. Why wouldn't he reload? It's what he's been doing for 30 years straight, but easily going to reload. You bring back Sarah Strong, the best freshman in the country. How mature she looked throughout the tournament was amazing. Normally, I think freshmen sometimes get overlooked a little bit because of the Paige Beckers of the world or the AZ Fudds. I actually think the opposite happened. I think Sarah Strong got so much attention, so much love, so much respect from the basketball community. We all know that she is about to be the next thing. Like, mm-hmm. She is about to be the next big thing in our sport. And then AZ Fudd. I mean, I have been through several knee injuries. I've had two ACL tears. So to see that young lady on this stage now, finally getting a chance to play healthy basketball with Paige Becker still here, with a young Sarah Strong, winning the most outstanding player for the game and just having that moment. I was so happy for AZ, and I felt like Paige was even happier for her. Mm-hmm. And that just goes to the type of teammate that Paige is and the type of selflessness that this team really has. But what a run. I think the last thing I'll say is just a great job by Dawn Staley in South Carolina. It's so interesting now. We have high expectations for these coaches. You know, we're like, it's a failure, Dawn. Like, she didn't win a national championship. She didn't go back to back. Bro, she was there. She was there. She made it there without having a star and premier big. There was no Asia Wilson. There was no Leah Boston. There's no Camila Cardoso. She just had the 10 McDonald's All-Americans, made it work throughout the season. Just had the 10 McDonald's All-Americans, made it work throughout the season, but still gets to her third national championship in the last 4 years. It hurts to see them like go out that way because you don't expect that. But at the same time, Dawn and Gino are showing us what sustained levels of excellence look like year after year after year. And it was fun to watch.
Sustained excellence is a big part of what you just said that did hit me over the weekend, because if you look at the way we talked about UConn's men's basketball a year ago, when they ran through the tournament and they won by huge margins of victory, we looked at that and said, is this the best tournament team of all time? They got back-to-back titles. It was, oh my God, how do we give them the glory for what they had? I got into a heated discussion with some people after the championship game from the women's side when they're like, yet another UConn blowout. Like, I don't understand as a general principle why, you know, people see UConn blow out in a championship game. It's like, well, women's college basketball is broken. There's really no balance. There's only one dominant team. Like, these narratives that are fed instead of celebrating greatness. And I think there is a level to what you said. Like, the season that South Carolina had this year and the expectation, the standard is the standard, as coaches always say. Like, the standard that they've set is remarkable. And for UConn to come in and just absolutely run through them that way, I think is a moment where we should step back and, instead of trying to find some fault to the process, reward the team that won. I think we just saw one of the more dominant performances in the course of a Final Four that we will ever see in women's college basketball, because the level of competition has gotten so high and they still got their butts whooped. Like, if you go in and you do that to the Final Four in the championship game at this level, to me, it's like, step back, tip of the cap, and let's have a conversation about how great it is instead of a conversation about anything that's broken in the process.
And the crazy thing on that dominant run in the Final Four, I mean, 30-point victories against UCLA and South Carolina in the Final Four and national championship, respectively. Paige Beckers didn't really do anything outstanding. She had 17 points against UCLA. Excuse me, 16 against UCLA, 17 against South Carolina. That's not nothing. But she had three consecutive 30-plus performances in the tournament. It was AZ Fudd, and it was Sarah Strong with a back-to-back double-double against UCLA and South Carolina. Sarah Strong had a double-double against three of the four one seeds that UConn played. USC, UCLA in South Carolina. She's a freshman. This is her first tournament. And a huge part of the reason why UConn wasn't just playing for but won a national championship was because of what Sarah Strong did. So this is very much so. This feels kind of like Paige's national championship. It was her swan song. It's how she's leaving UConn is at the top, the pinnacle of the college basketball world. You couldn't ask for anything more. But if you dig a little bit deeper and think about, okay, UConn's future, Geno's future, I think it's fair to question a coach that's 71 years old and has been doing this for 40 years. And in a college basketball landscape that's changing a lot, that he's been very outspoken about how he doesn't like, how long is Gino really going to want to coach? Does Gino want to go out on top? Does he want to hang it up? If I'm Gino Auriemma, I'm looking at what Sarah and AZ did and the fact that they are returning next year and thinking, why would I want to step away from this? I just had this duo that's part of a trio that's one of the best, if not the best, in women's college basketball, if not college basketball as a whole. Why would I want to step away from this? So that makes this UConn team even more menacing. It's not just like a one-off of, bye, Paige, good luck in the WNBA. We'll go reload for next season. It's like, no, we've got our next Paige. We've got our next Maya Moore, our next Breonna Stewart, our next DT, whoever, yeah, Caroline, you know, name your UConn legend, I mean, pick, you know, choose your fighter. They're coming back next year.
They're always going to have that, though. That's the crazy thing for Gino.
They're always going to be the next one.
They'll find the next Sarah. Say, like,
it's always going to be the dilemma. Yeah.
Yeah, there will always be the next one.
Yeah, you know, there's interest. And there's been a wave of coaches recently who have been legendary coaches, won national championships, and have retired on the women's side. There's been, you know, Atara Vandeveer, who retired last year. And if you ask many, she retired after becoming the winningest head coach at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, she knew eventually if Dino was going to keep coaching, he was going to pass her. But when she retired last year, she had that title. She had that feat solely to herself. Her name was across that. There was a whole celebration. There was a whole jacket given to her with all the 1,000-and-something wins that she has had before. For example, a Muffet McGraw, different type of story. Sorry. Back to Tara Vandeveer, though. That year, Stanford was not good. They weren't good. They were like 500. They weren't a tournament team necessarily, but she ended on a high note because she became all-time winningest head coach. Muffet McGraw, head coach of Notre Dame women's basketball, had won 2 championships within, like, I think a 5-year span. Arike Gumbawale hits mm-hmm. that buzzer beater in the Final Four and then in the national championship. We remember that years ago. The year after that she decided to retire, Notre Dame was below 500. They sucked. Never seen Notre Dame suck in an ACC before. Carolina's never been a thing. Every time I played Notre Dame, they gave us a 30-piece. It wasn't even close. We were done in the first quarter, like, bad. But she decided to retire after an off year. Gino's not going to have that. There's not going to be an off year. You said it. He's been a 16 out of the last 17 Final Fours. Not Final Fours. Not conference championships. Not the tournament. Not the Sweet 16. Like Tom Izzo squad. The Final freaking Four. So I feel like it won't have anything to do with the players. It won't have anything to do with the probability to win a national championship. It'll just be when Gino decides that he really wants to be a full-time pop-up. He really wants to sit down and relax and let somebody take over the reins. Because otherwise, he could do it till he's 90, and they could have a chance to win 8 more championships before then.
And that's kind of how I felt when Nick Saban decided to hang it up. And I brought him up once and bringing him up again because that is the kind of caliber of coach that I view Gino. Like, that is the standard that he has set for himself. I thought Nick Saban would want to go out on top, and he didn't. He didn't win a championship in his final season. He just got to the point where he said, I can't do this to the level that I need to do this, the level that the expectation level that I have set for myself, the amount that I feel like I have to give every single day in recruiting and coaching and game planning and just general coaching. I can't do it anymore. So it didn't matter what the accolades were. I mean, Nick Saban had plenty of accolades. Gino Auriemma has plenty of accolades. He said it post-game, you know, during the trophy presentation, after the confetti has fallen, he's like, look, this doesn't change my life. I will wake up tomorrow and I will do the exact same thing that I did yesterday and that I did the day before. I already had 11. Their lives are changed. So I think if Gino gets to, they are meeting his team, that all, his entire team, their lives are changed because they will now be a national champion. I feel like Gino probably is wired very similarly to Saban, that if he gets to the point where he can't give what he needs to give, that's his sign. But for now, I mean, if you're willing to give what it takes to give and you're re-energized by a national championship, you're re-energized by this young talent, then why step away now?
I don't want to see him go. You know, I don't want to see him go. They won four championships in a row between 2013 to 2016. And they
that
went
wasn't
on
that
a
long ago.
Eight. Yeah, but you know what, though? And you call them this basketball history, 8 to 9 years without a championship.
That's a lot.
Is an eternity. Is an eternity. I mean, Paige almost went 5 years without one. That would have seemed like a lifetime. I can't imagine her conversation with Breanna Stewart where Stewie's like, I mean, yeah, we won four. Yep. We won every year. You got to get one before you come to the WNBA. But in all seriousness, it's good for the game. You know, the sustained level of dominance is good for the game. I think you could say comfortably that the reason we have a Dawn Staley or a Corey Close or had a Muppet McGraw is because of the level that Gina Auriemma raised these coaches to on the woman's side, where they had to figure out how to compete with him. They had to figure out how to shut down the dynasty. And we saw that the last few years, but I think it's really good for the game that you call women's basketball is back on top. And couldn't be happier for Paige Bueckers.
100%. That was my first thought after, you know, really after the third quarter, what I knew UConn was going to win was good for Paige. Good for Paige, because I know that she came to UConn expecting not just a national championship, but championships. Now, multiple were not in the question. We're not in the cards. But at least one. And I think that does, to a certain extent, change her legacy. I'm not going to view Caitlin Clark any differently in what she did for women's college basketball because she doesn't have a championship. But when you do have one, I mean, that closes the door for any sort of skepticism. We'll take a quick break
here. You can say it a little more with your chest. You can say a little more with your chest when you got one behind you.
That chest is puffed out just a little bit more.
Yeah, someone saying you're a good singer, then you have a Grammy to support it. You know, it's just a little different.
Yeah. I don't need you to tell me, because I've got a shiny new toy on my trophy shelf to tell me. But quick note on that, though, the 2020 recruiting class, Paige Bueckers, the number one overall player in that class, national championship. Angel Reese, a top five player in that class, national championship. Camila Cardoso, a top five player in that class, national championship. Tiana Pau-Pau, top 10 player in that class, national championship. If you just go take a look at the rivals' top 20 players in the 2020 class, in the women's college basketball recruiting class, you will see, oh, trophy, 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 trophy. That class has changed. Caitlin Clark is in that class as well. Obviously doesn't have a championship, but I'm not going to say she didn't need one, but she didn't really need one like that. It's a who's who. A who's who.
That's going to be a different podcast. It's going to be a different pod. We'll circle back on that.
Yeah, that is what we in the industry call a tease for the next show. But we will look ahead to draft stock. What has this tournament done for both the men's and women's side in terms of draft stock? We'll get into that coming up next. So we just touched on legacies, championships, how that changes your legacy. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I do think that Cooper Flagg not winning a national championship at Duke changes his legacy just a bit. Obviously, he's the best player in the country, have the awards to back it up. But it's different if you raised a banner versus going home in truly gut-wrenching fashion in the Final Four. Does that do anything, Fitz, in your opinion, to his draft stock?
No, it doesn't. And I will say that there's growth, room for growth in his game, and that's okay. Like, that's the thing that Ice and I talked about this the other day. We have to understand that Cooper Flagg, two things can be true. He can be the best player in college basketball this season. He can be a phenom in every possible way. And he's still got growing to do. Like, he's still, you know, at this point, He should have been a senior in high school. So we're asking somebody that should have been a senior in high school to suddenly come in as a polished product. Like, I think we need to understand that it's about the starting point in relation to where the end point is. Like Kobe Bryant, when he was drafted, was not Kobe Bryant by the end of his time in the NBA, right? LeBron looks like a different human being. We all know that, right? And when you think about the age, I want to put that conversation around Cooper a little bit because, yeah, I mean, he had a couple of times this year that he had game-winning shot and he missed them. I think he'll learn from that. Like, he struggled in this tournament to take on long, big guards. I think he'll learn from that. Like, there's just a moment here where, hey, let's acknowledge that this is the beginning of Cooper Flagg's ride. Like, there's no doubt in the world that, presuming he comes out, and I can't imagine he doesn't, that he's going to be the first pick and he's going to be absolutely praised with that first pick. He's going to be a phenom coming in. Let's just remember that so is Zion, right? So it's not about where you start in the league. It's about what you do once you get there. There's been no indication that Cooper's anything other than addicted to the work. I think he's going to be an absolutely great professional basketball player. I also think that this tournament, yeah, it didn't end in a championship. In 5 years, that's not what anybody will remember about Cooper Flagg.
I totally agree.
I don't think it should change anything in terms of his draft stock. I mean, it felt pretty clear pretty early on this season that he would be the number one overall pick. Yes, the loss is gut-wrenching. Yes, Duke fans and Cooper Flagg himself and John Shire and that entire team would have loved to have raised a banner, but that doesn't change in the slightest what he did throughout the regular season. Look at the women's side, Ice. Paige Bueckers will be the number one overall pick. She came into this season as the projected number one overall pick. She has done nothing except solidify that. Solidify Dallas that is our future, who does, in fact, have the number one overall pick. If you look at the tournament as a whole, who on the women's side has boosted their draft stock the most?
Yeah. First, I'll say Anissa Morrow of LSU. She has been a double-double machine for her career. Over 100 double-doubles she has had throughout the course of her career. Started back playing for DePaul. I used to watch and cover a ton of the Big East, so I saw her up close, and then obviously finished with Kim Mulkey and LSU. What makes her terrific is that she's an undersized four player that still will out-rebound you because of her toughness, because of her strength, because of her grit, because of her athleticism. And at the next level, you need great rebounders. And so I think that there is a team that is going to find a spot for Anissa Morrow based on her physicality, what she can bring to the next level. And then I believe that she'll grow on her scoring as well. Not necessarily a three-point shooter, but with the size that she's at, she's going to have to learn to be more comfortable on the perimeter. I think, you know, a player that I was always rooting for, and it was questionable whether she would have a life in the WNBA, was Haley Van Lith. If you had asked me this time last year, I would have said, I don't think there's a roster who will keep a Haley Van Lith. She was between being a two guard, not really a point guard, not really a great defender for LSU. Last year when she was with them on their run to, I believe, an Elite Eight. And this year with what she was able to do with TCU and Sedona Prince, the majority of the scoring, the majority of the facilitating, handling pressure, weathering the storms, and the resilience that she has, Haley Van Lith is like a trained assassin. You know, somebody gets her in the right system, doing the right things, and making sure that she's valued. Haley Van Lith, I think, could have a very good career in the WNBA. And I believe that her hunger for the game and the way that she's been battle-tested makes her more attractive to WNBA coaches and GMs at the next level. Mm-hmm. Think like Azaia Cook, who got drafted and stayed with the LSU Sparks for a couple of years and hasn't necessarily been able to stay on a roster this year. A Haley Van Lith is like her, where it can be a two guard that's a backup two guard that can come in the game, that can be versatile and make a difference. To me, those were the two players that throughout the course of the tournament, I was like, oh yeah, okay. You wanted to make sure that GMs were like, yes, we need to make sure that we go and get them. We need to make sure that they have a training camp invitation. We need to make sure that they're in a first round draft. I think Anissa Morrow and Haley Van Lith are going to have really good careers in the W. And the best thing about the W right now is expansion, yeah, is that there are more and more teams, which means that we can keep more of these players. So I'm also hoping, no disrespect to my old heads in the league, but those that continue to retire and move on, the Elena Deladons who we're going to miss, the Diana Taurasis who we're going to miss. And these are players that changed the game of basketball. We're starting to see them retire in bulk. And now hopefully we can keep some of these younger college players who have captivated the college game, who have captivated women's basketball as it's been growing, and can market and can be marketed and capitalized in the WNBA. So I also think we're going to see a wave of our younger players staying in the league, which is what we as fans want, because we're most connected to those who play college basketball.
It's a trickle-up effect, for sure. That, like, there's a reason why Indiana Fever tickets are the most expensive in the WNBA, and that is because of Caitlin Clark and the popularity that she had at Iowa and has only grown in the WNBA. Haley Van Lithen and Issa Morrow were the two that were at the top of my mind. Marcus Stroman is a pitcher in MLB, and his kind of tagline is HDMH, height don't measure heart. And that is exactly how I view Anissa Morrow and Haley Van Lith. Like, they're both viewed probably as maybe a little bit undersized in the W. But you look at Anissa Morrow, the way that she grinds, double-double machine. She had 30 this past season. I believe the only game in the tournament when she did not have a double-double was in a loss in the Elite Eight against UCLA. And then Haley Van Lith. I don't know how you watch her game and not just see on full display a grind, just a passion and a desire to win, to carry her team. She's a spark plug for TCU this past year. So height don't measure heart. Those are two that I'm pumped to see in the W.
Let me ask you this, though, because you guys sort of glossed over Paige. So what is the expectation for the biggest star that's going to be the first overall pick? Like, what is her ice in your mind? What's the immediate impact that Paige Bueckers makes to the WNBA?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Double figure score. She's going to a Dallas team that already has one of the best scorers in the world, in Arike Ogunbowale. Some would put, you know, Asia, Nafisa, Arike, Nafisa, Asia, Arike, like, is one of the best scorers. So I think, one, the benefit in having Paige on the floor is that she doesn't need the ball in her hand to score. Paige can be run off screens, run off stagger screens, curl action, catch and shoot, knockdown. She's a very efficient player. Think like Klay Thompson scoring 30 points off 11 dribbles or something crazy that we saw years ago. Like, those could be the type of games that Paige has. So I think at the next level for a Dallas organization that has gotten rid of some of their star power recently, that is banking on Paige coming in and being one of their stars, I'm expecting her to score double figures. I'm also expecting her to have about 5 assists a game. Like, I think her numbers are going to be around 12 and 5. 14 and 5. I think there's going to be some growing pains with her working with another major scorer in Arike Ogunbowale, who is ball dominant, who needs to have the ball in her hands to get her shot off. But make no mistake about it, offensively, Paige is going to be called on to be a major contributor for the Dallas Wings this upcoming season. And it'll be fun to watch, because I think she's ready for the challenge. And already hearing the whispers from Arike Ogunbowale, she is ready to have Paige Bueckers on her squad. I'm not sure, you know, we talk about guard duos in the W, and it'll be, this might be the little bit of a tease, but could they end up being the best backcourt duo towards the end? Could they end up being the best scoring duo?
It could be incredibly possible. And Fitz, I'm glad that you brought Paige back into the conversation, because I just did, I think, what so many people are guilty of like, look, you're great. Okay, we expect you to be great, but how about everybody else? But I think that is the expectation for Paige Bueckers, greatness in the WNBA. I know you two have flights to catch. Good trip in San Antonio?
Great trip.
Great
trip.
So many people have said that San Antonio is an awesome host.
Wait,
site.
Don't gloss over it. You were in Tampa. Like,
yeah, Tampa
look,
was amazing.
We had 92 degrees one day, no lie, and then a wind chill of 30 the next. Okay, so like, you went from you were in Tampa. Like, I had friends that were down in Tampa that were spending their time on a boat. We were not doing. We went from butt crack sweat to needing 4 jackets. Like, that's what we did.
It was perfect weather. every single day. And I say that because I love heat and humidity. And it was like 90 degrees and incredibly humid every single day. I live in Nashville, and every single day I was gone, there were tornadoes in Nashville. So I was enjoying laying by the pool, perfect weather. It was gorgeous. Tampa's amazing. Everyone there at Amalie Arena, so hospitable. The town fully embraced the Final Four. Tampa was amazing.
I also want to say, I'm happy to be here at the men's Final Four, but the comment that Gino Auriemma made about seeing the most woman reporters he's ever seen at the women's Final Four, and then saying that he was proud of you all, was a highlight of the tournament. How adorable. Again, Pop-Pop Gino. I'm a huge fan of Pop-Pop Gino. Gino 10 years ago would have been like, I don't care who's here. Ask the question, I'm getting out of here. But Gino in 2025? Cares to show some love. But I also thought that was great. So shout out to you, Caroline, for being at your first Women's Final Four. I hope you did experience it. It was awesome last year when I went. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It was an amazing experience. And not just shout out to the town, because, you know, Tampa was amazing. Everyone that I met was so excited to be there, excited for me that I was there. It was very open and warm and welcoming. And it's true. You know, it was... I have covered so many men's events, and I love that. National championships, Super Bowls, and you name it, I've covered it, and I feel very grateful to have done so. This was my first major women's sporting event that I have covered, and it was so incredible and so refreshing to see so many women, young women in college that are getting into the industry, older women who have been around and have probably, you know, pulled up several seats at the table for us to be able to do this. So it was, having Gino kind of have that reflection was incredible. It was great to kind of get the flowers that all female reporters and women's basketball players deserve. But yeah, it was a very cool experience. We missed you, Ice, but you were holding it down in San Antonio. We were proud of you.
Yes.
Okay.
I had to keep Fitz in line over here.
It's a full-time job.
Somebody's got to. Next year, someone's private jet will just bounce from space to space. I still believe, I know I got to go, but I still believe that they would be well served to put both of these in the same city. That's all I'm saying. There was a question that came up several times. The men's coaches all kept saying, I think it'd be great. I don't know how it would work. I still think being in this city, in San Antonio, they could have put one in the arena and one in the dome and made it a celebration of the sport. I truly, truly hate, as somebody that loves both of these sports we're talking about, I truly hate that I have to make a conscious decision on what I'm going to be at. I wish we lived in a world where they could find a way to celebrate the entire sport of basketball, where men's and women's are put together and displayed in a way that can let both games grow and let both audiences be a part of all of it. That's just my NCAA. You're supposed to be the smartest people in the world. You run the lives of college kids. Be smart enough to figure out how to bring all of them together. Like, I'm just saying, for once, I want the NCAA to do something proactively and intelligently. For once.
Fits for NCAA my commissioner.
Drop. I'll take the job.
Or critic. Yeah, either one. I approve of the campaign. And while we are campaigning for certain things, can we stop having championship games on Monday night? On a school night? Like, I think the women do it right. I know there was a lot of, you know, talk about putting the women in primetime on Sunday. Frankly, I think 3 p.m. Eastern time on a Sunday, this time of year when you're not really competing with much else, is pretty close to prime time. But 3 p.m. on a Sunday, perfect. 8 o'clock on a Monday night, men, get it together.
Yeah.
It's too late. Yeah. I need my beauty
sleep. And for the women's game, it's what we're used to. If you locked in throughout the season, you know that Sundays at 2 o'clock, you better turn something on because there's a prime time game that's happening. So I also think it was consistent. And I like that. At least they kept it consistent. Those who have consumed the sport know that Sundays, midday, it's the time to watch women's college basketball, baby.
100%. Yeah, people are telling on themselves. 100%. People are telling on themselves when they start, like, they're like, why are they doing this? Like, I'm just saying, some people are telling on themselves a little bit.
You ain't been here before. Right. This is your first Sunday. Hold on. You ain't been here in a couple.
Welcome to the family.
But also, let me show you the ropes. okay, that is going to do it for us today. He is Jason Fitz. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason Fitz. She is at IceYoung23. I am at Caroline Fenton1. like the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, review, tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell a UConn and a Florida fan, because they are riding high today, as they very well should. They are the champions. Thanks for tuning in to the College Basketball Power Hour. Next time that you hear from us, we will be the College Football Power Hour again. So a little something to look forward to as the fall approaches. But appreciate y'all. If it's your first time, welcome in. Thanks for stopping in. If you've been here the whole season, appreciate you as well. We are out. We'll